Can't help it.
You're going to be that guy, aren't you?
Of all the guys you can be, you got to be that guy? Jeez.
Have you met Brad? You know.
Brad's such a jerk.
Who was the guy in your school when you were growing up that everyone hated? Was there a guy? And
hated because he was like
a jerk.
A jerk. Yes, there was.
And what was his name?
I'm not going to say that.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. The name, his first name, when you meet other people with that first name throughout your life, are they tainted by that person?
No, not really, because it's such a common.
Oh, his name was Bill, wasn't it?
It was. It still is. No, his first name was Bob.
Oh, okay.
But I have an uncle named Bob. So, you know, and Bob, you meet a lot of Bobs or Roberts.
There's Bobs all over the place.
Yeah. And.
Wait, are you telling me that Bob is literally your uncle?
But Bob is my uncle. Yeah. Yeah. And then Bob's Big Boy. Sure. You guys don't have that out here, but Bob's Big Boy was a big thing growing up.
Yeah, those are huge.
Yeah.
As are their burgers, from what I understand.
It's true. I have a, it's not inflatable. It's a, like a Bob's Big Boy piggy bank on the shelf behind me.
Is it good?
Yeah, it's cute. Adrian got it for me at the thrift.
Oh, the thrift, you say? I get lots of stuff from the thrift.
So do we. Our house is chock full of stuff from the thrift.
Actually, I don't think I've ever bought anything at a thrift shop, have I? I tried.
You're missing out, man. Thrift stores are the best.
Hey, have you used Craigslist lately?
I've never used Craigslist. I know what it is and I've seen it, but I've never done a transaction or anything.
Okay, I've put up a number of things on Craigslist lately at really low prices or nearly free, like here, just come take this, and have not gotten any bites. It's like I'm blacklisted from Craigslist, or Craigslist is just no longer used. I don't know what's going on.
What are you trying to get rid of?
My 88 key weighted piano controller that I had for 30 years, my Fattar controller, which is like a really nice thing.
Well, it's got to be heavy though, right? You can't just have somebody roll up on.
Well,
on
somebody have to roll up in a skateboard. Car. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it weighs 50 pounds, but I'm giving it away. I think there's one key broken down the bottom, but I think it can be fixed. But I figured for somebody in New York City, wouldn't somebody be like, "Oh, I'll take that and I'll fix it for $10"? You know.
You would think.
Not a single.
Yeah,
bite.
You would. Really?
Yep.
And are you just giving it away? Are you charging a little bit of money for it?
I said $20 on the listing just to keep the people who just. Take everything that's free. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
Because I want it to go to a good home.
And yeah, then, you don't want to just put it out.
And then
the
in the listing, I say, I don't really even need the money. I just want it to go to a good home. And nothing. Yeah, it's a sad world.
Sell it for $4,000 and include a Fuji camera with it.
It has to be more than $4,000 after what I've spent. Oh, God. So much money. It's funny. A young friend of mine came over the other day with a Fuji X-T50. Is that like their little mirrorless? Like the
gosh, I'm so out of the loop.
Anyway,
I know there's an X-T5. Maybe there's a 50. I don't know. I'm really out of the loop.
Yeah, the X-T50
cameras.
Are sort of like the next step down. They're like the smaller, a few features less than like the X-T5 or X-T4. It's like that would be the X-T50. You know.
Okay.
And she comes over and I'm playing with it. I'm trying to get the lenses to work. And sometimes the back wheel was aperture and sometimes front wheel was shutter speed. But when you used an adapted lens, front wheel was an aperture. Oh, and back. Huh. And I was like, this is the most maddening piece of technology I've ever used in my life. And it made me hate my Fuji even more.
You put it even deeper into the closet.
Yes.
I'm going to put you behind something now. How do you like that?
Yeah, you better mm-hmm. you understand how you feel. You better figure out what you did
just
wrong.
Think about what you've done. Yeah, well, boy. So it sounds like we had the same dad.
I don't think I ever had that. Did you get in trouble a lot when you were a kid?
No, I didn't get in trouble a lot. I was just often a disappointment. So
Oh, that's
a different
that's
thing.
Even worse.
Yeah, Yeah. Kind of. Because you're like, wait, I didn't do anything this time. Hold on. Here, let me break something so it'll at least be worth it.
So I can actually learn a lesson as it is.
I mean, if you're going to be pissed at me, let me at least get something out of it.
Oh, man, that's funny. The a crazy thing happened yesterday.
On the way to the forum?
Yes. Oh, there we go. We have notes. So there's a song by a guy named Pepper Adams. He's a Barry sax player, jazz guy.
Okay. Still with us, or is this an older person?
No, gone, he died in 1984, I think.
Okay.
I knew a girl in college when I went to UConn for a couple of years, named Lisa Ladone. Hi, Lisa, if you happen to be listening.
Hi, Lisa.
She was...
Oh, she just said hi back.
Wait, she's at your house? Wait a minute. Lisa! we were driving around one day and she played me this tune because she was a Barry sax player in the jazz orchestra there. Mm. And it was just, it's just great. Like, it's just really good. It's called Conjuration. It's on a live album called Conjuration. Okay. It's the first tune. And I've thought about this tune, like, I've listened to it over and over again. In fact, I think I still have her CD that she lent me that I never gave back. So sorry, Lisa Ladone. But I was thinking about it the other day since I got this piano, right? This is going somewhere, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It always is.
They know. They know by now.
So I've been playing around on the piano trying to learn some tunes, like things that I have always thought, oh, I should try to figure that out, or I should try to learn that. Let me go back and do that. Like, basically, let's go finish that unfinished thread that I was, that
okay.
I was making.
Okay. Yep. And this is where the phone call came. Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha.
So one of the things that I was trying to figure out, there's a few things. One, my old friend, Andrea Mann, my British friend, singer in London, she did a record once where they did this, tune, All the Way. Yeah, I need you all the way, the good and the years and all the in-between years, come what may. It's a Sinatra song. Sinatra sang it in some movie back in the 60s. And there's a line, it just goes, who knows where the road will lead us, only a fool can say. You know, it's like that kind of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So anyway, he's playing, she had an ex named Barry who was like this amazing pianist. And he came in on her record and he played accompaniment. But like most piano accompaniment is like, oh, that person's good. But it's not like I almost want to hear the accompaniment as much as I want to hear the vocal, you know.
Right.
But
right.
He does this one moment where he hits these notes where you're like, what? What? Like, it just stops you. You're like, wait, that works? And it worked, you know? And it's bothered me for years. So the other day, Heather was
wait a minute. As a non-musician, you're surprised that it worked because the notes shouldn't go together?
They're weird. I don't know. Can you hear that?
Yeah.
So like he does
okay.
Like that. That's what he plays.
So it's a little dissonant, but it still works.
It's super, it's like out and sparse, but interesting. And like, he's just, you know, it's just like a master at work, you know, like this guy was really good. So I decided the other day to figure that out, as you can tell, because I just played it for you. Yep. The other day, I was like, I'm just going to spend the next 20 minutes and figure out what the heck he's doing here, because it was weird and complicated, didn't make much sense. So I've been starting to do more of that stuff. So I kind of finished that one. I think I'm going to go back to it and try to learn his whole part, like just try to figure out the 2 minutes, just because it's fascinating. And I think I'll learn more doing that than I will anything. But there
could you get the stems or anything from Andrea so you can isolate that part?
It's a good question, actually. I could ask her. But I mean, even as it is, I think I can figure it out. There are also things online now, AI things, where you can upload a recording and it will give you the notes on staff.
Terrifying.
Yeah. But that's a whole other thing we'll get to at some other point. So on top of this All the Way song, I also really love this Conjuration song. And I was listening to it over and over again the other night. I was like, man, it'd be really cool if I could learn like one of the solos on this song. Not Pepper Adams solo, because I'm not into that one. But there's this guy, Kenny Wheeler, who plays flugelhorn on it, who plays this really great kind of cool solo. And I was like, oh, let me learn that Kenny Wheeler solo. And I've started trying to figure it out. I was like, man, this is so complicated, the form and everything. Like, what's going on here? And then I remembered that I have a friend who plays Barry Sax in the Village Vanguard Orchestra where Pepper Adams used to play.
Oh, wow.
So I write this guy, Frank Basile, and I said, hey, Frank, do you happen to have a lead sheet to Conjuration? And he said, yeah, not only do I have a lead sheet to Conjuration, I have the lead sheet to Conjuration in Pepper Adams' handwriting.
No way.
And he sent it to me last night.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, just from like a jazz history thing. You know what I mean?
That's crazy.
And so I was just like messing around with
it. So what, he just like scanned it with his phone or something?
Yeah, sent me a PDF.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just kind of neat to like have, and I guess, so there's two things in here. One is just the physical thing that you and I sort of get off on about, yeah, like, you know, yeah, just like it being a real thing in the world.
Yes. An object that was touched by the person who, yeah.
Right. So like there's that. There's the fact that I happen to know the guy who would have a copy of that.
That's almost the craziest thing. Like the fact that it exists is not that surprising, but the fact that you happen to know the person that can get it to you, that's...
Yeah, that 20 minutes after I decide I want it, I can find a copy because I know a lot of people. Like, it makes me happy that
oh,
I live...
Oh, and there it is. Look at that.
Bill
just sent me a copy of this PDF.
How cool is that?
Wow.
Ah, it's so good. So,
wow.
So anyway, just from like a, like the point of view, and then even, you know, and he even said, he's just like, if you'll notice, like the, there's like two bars or four bars of intro before what starts on the sheet in the recording. So just be aware of that. And I was like, oh my God.
And
it
was
is.
That just improv'd?
I mean, I guess it's probably something they worked out because they're playing it in unison. So it's probably something he worked out like that night or whatever it is. But the point is that, you know, in going back to sort of finish things that were unfinished.
Yeah.
I have found new things.
Yes. And that's, Bill called me the other day and said, hey, I'm going through this thing. What do you think of this? Is this true for you? Have you either done this in the past or are you doing it now? And as is often the case, Bill and I kind of parallel experiences sometimes of what we're going through. And this happened to be one of those things where, yeah, I mean, I've been going back and either relearning skills that I had that I'd like to sharpen up, like 3D. And, yep. and I brought my sewing machine up from the basement and am teaching myself to sew again. I really, and it sounds like the same as you. I didn't realize how much I missed some of these things until I started doing them again or yes. going back to them again.
And
there's value there that I hadn't either seen or noticed or whatever it was.
Does it make you feel more like yourself?
Yes.
Whatever that
yes.
means, whatever that definition well, okay. is, right?
Because I can't speak for you, but my history has been sort of, you know, moving on to the next thing, yep. either consciously or unconsciously in service of capitalism, right? In
sure.
service of finding that thing that's going to hit, finding, doing that project that's going to get me, you know, fame and fortune and notoriety and, you know, shaving cream ads and whatever.
Sure.
Right. Where I think both of us are either at or approaching or moving through is this idea of, I want to revisit some of the things that lit me up back then.
Right.
And A, see if they still light me up, or B, see what they lead to now.
Yes. Yeah. I'm never going to be a world-class jazz pianist. Could I be a better jazz pianist than I was when I was in music school? Yes, I can.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that, and it was always unsatisfying to me. Like that little thing that I just played there, I just, you know, plunked it out to prove to you like yep. the weird yep. notes. But, you know, even in those few bars, I see things now that I don't think I would have seen when I was 20 years old in music school.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I've had 30 years.
And you can explore them for different reasons.
Yes. I've had 30 years to percolate.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like a stew that's been like sitting there for a while. It's like the all of the different tastes have merged into each other a little bit.
Yeah. I would imagine there's some of this idea that you don't have anything to prove anymore.
Yeah. I can do it for myself.
Yes. You're not on stage anymore in that way.
Yep.
You're figuring things out for the joy of figuring it out and the satisfaction of going, yes, nailed it.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, Heather got off her podcast and I have this like big smile on my face because I figured out 4 bars of music.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it was satisfying. It was cool, right? You know, and then, you know, getting this lead sheet, as little as it is, it's just like, oh, I have like-minded people in my life for whom the things that we're doing aren't necessarily for anything more than doing them, having the experience of doing them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, yeah, you could pull out your sewing machine and start doing stuff, but are you going to be creating new sets for people? Well, maybe if there's some like local theater group who needs some help.
But that's not the goal. That's not the goal.
No. You're going to make some new curtains for the living room.
Yeah. I called my friend Michael, who I have been friends with. Michael was a grad student at Cal State Long Beach in costume design when I was an undergrad. And then when he got his master's, he went on to run the costume shop for the next 30 odd years. And he's an incredible designer, absolutely stunning. And we've been friends ever since. And I called him and told him kind of what I've been thinking about. And he's like, that's fantastic. He's like, you always loved it. You were always good at it. He said, just start small, make a pillow,
yeah,
make a pair of drawstring pants, you know, start simple. And he said, and if I can give you any advice, make something simple that you want to give away, because you will go slowly. You'll bring your best game to it, because now it's not for you. It's for somebody else.
Yeah.
And you want it to be good.
Yeah.
You're not going to rush through it just to satisfy some whim. You're going to take your time. You're going to do it right. And he said, I think you'll enjoy yourself.
I do like, though, that he's telling you to make things that you could possibly use as an old man. You're like, make yourself a pillow, some drawstring pants, maybe a blanket.
Get some barge cement, make yourself some slippers. Who knows? Who knows?
No, I totally agree.
You may not need them now, but you will.
Yeah, isn't it funny? Yeah. I mean, is the sharing with somebody else a necessary thing for you for that? I mean, does that give you more?
I don't know that it does, but I understand why he suggested it. I understand where he's coming from.
Yep.
Because you do, I think we do bring a different, not version of ourselves, but we do bring a different level of maybe care and patience when the thing that we're making is for someone else.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So I can see that. Do I have any illusions that it's going to be anything other than me just pursuing something because I used to really love it? No, not at all. And that's the thing that it sounds like you're getting to the same place. That's enough.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm enough. Right?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think I've spent the last 20 years taking pictures, and I like being a photographer, and I've made a living being a photographer, and I've had some success being a photographer. Like being a photographer has been good to me, you know, as good as it has been any photographer in the last 20 years as the entire industry implodes.
Right.
But I've, you know, as I think I've said before, it's like, I've never cried by looking at a photograph, but I've cried listening to music.
Absolutely.
I've cried looking at a painting, even though I can't paint. You know, it's just like there are things that visual art doesn't quite do for me what music does.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you're wired that way, or did your early experiences of performing and then studying teach you that kind of response?
Well,
or is it a combination of both?
Sure.
Can both be true?
I wanted to do that kind of stuff because I was moved by it. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, my grandfather was a pretty serious musician. So there was that, and you know, my sister and I both played piano, but my sister didn't end up going to music school. Right.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
But I think even more than that, there's this feeling that I had. All right. Can we get deep for a second here?
No, no. I think the shallows are where we tend to live.
Since it's only just you and I.
That's right. At this point, there's probably a lot of truth to that.
All right. This started somewhere else.
Yeah.
I was playing piano a week and a half ago. And
okay, before you jump into that, remind me when you started playing piano first. How old were you? What is this? Oh, teenager?
No. First grade, second grade.
Is it really? Okay. Somewhere I've only ever seen like the videos of
high
school, kind of as teenager.
Yeah. I started playing. My sister and I took Suzuki lessons. You know,
I don't know what that means.
He was a Japanese violin teacher back in the mid 20th century who. The big thing, the famous thing about it is that it's generally learning from ear by ear. So you listen to recordings of people playing the music like over and over and over again on endless tapes before you,
rather than looking at charts and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is good and bad. I have mixed feelings about that part of my education, but yeah, I played when I was a kid. My mother used to come into our rooms and like, as we were going to bed, make us listen to some, you know, Mozart minuet or whatever it is over and over
before
again.
Before you can go to sleep?
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. I mean, not in a, like a mean way, but just in a like, here, like,
listen, like here, listen to this.
Yeah. You know, I'm sure.
And would you listen to those things with the intent of learning how to play them?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Or just to appreciate?
You would listen to it over and over and over again, and then you would learn to play that. And then you would listen to the next thing over and over again. This is just like the style that he started with violins. And there's videos of people playing, like, 2000 kids playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star variations, like in a big, it's like a little, it's a little cultish actually. But it's what, for whatever reason, that's what we started learning piano on. And when I left my house that I grew up in, and when my mother moved, I went up and I went through all the stuff in my room that was left, right? You know, stuff all the way back to like, you know, kindergarten. There was like my, you know, reading books from first grade, like just random stuff that was there, detritus of life kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Not like in a hoarder way, just in a, oh, what's that little pile over there? Oh, that's stuff from elementary school or whatever. And I threw most of it out. I took pictures of most of it. I threw most of it out. You know, one thing I did actually, just a little aside, I took pictures of, our friend Chris was over the other day and we were talking about REM.
Yep.
And I said, what was your first favorite REM album? And one of the things he said, he was like, oh, I really loved Green. And I said, oh, I saw REM on the Green tour, like fifth row or whatever. And he's like, my first concert was the Green tour in Boston. And it turned out we went to the same concert 2 days apart.
That's funny.
Cause I was in Hartford and he was in Boston. And so I found the ticket I took a picture of the ticket when I was going through all my papers. This was, you know, 15 years ago or whatever it is when my mom moved out of the house. So I know somewhere in my papers, I had some sheet music from school and I thought I had a lead sheet for this tune, Blame It on My Youth, which Keith Jarrett does a really great version on the album, The Cure. You should listen to it. It's really great. And I'm like, oh, I must have a lead sheet because I played it for one of my like competency kind of things in school. And so I pull out this bucket that I have in the closet that is like everything from 25 years old and earlier is in this little bucket, you know. And I'm flipping through the bucket and trying to get to the bottom to get to the music because the sheet music was at the bottom. And I came upon a 1982 Topps baseball sticker book. Do you remember? Does this ring any bells?
Yeah.
So for those who don't know, I was not a huge sports fan growing up. Still, definitely am not now. But back in the day, my father used to give me baseball cards. We collected some baseball cards. I wasn't really into the baseball. I was into the collecting the cards.
Mm-hmm. And the act of collecting.
Yeah. And when I was in second grade, my father gave me this book and you would get these, you'd get the book, which by the way, cost 25 cents empty.
Yeah.
And he bought a couple boxes of the stickers that would come in these packs, like little packs, like, you know, you rip the top off and inside
little, now they're Mylar. Then they were probably wax paper.
Well, wax paper for the cards. These would probably still be plastic or I don't know what the hell it was. Paper. Actually, I think it was like, So you would rip it open and there'd be what looked like little baseball cards, but they were actually little stickers and you'd find the place in the book. Oh, here's the Cincinnati Reds. here's mm-hmm, the spot mm-hmm. for Johnny Bench or whatever it is. Yeah. And you'd rip the back off and you'd stick it in. So my father would give me these stickers. He did it as some sort of incentive thing, like when I was in 1982, like, oh, if you're a good boy or you do your chores or you get good grades or whatever it is, you get a pack or two of stickers to like complete this thing. Mm-hmm, it's like an, mm-hmm. you know. But then, and I hope my mom's not listening, I found where the stickers were hidden.
I don't have to be good anymore. I know your secret, old man.
I've hijacked this entire situation. Kobayashi Maru my ass.
That's right. That's right. I don't believe in a no-win situation.
So I would sneak stickers.
Yeah.
And I would fill in the book, and it was very satisfying filling in the book. I'm not a huge completionist, but, you know, until I got to the end of the second box of stickers, and then I wasn't complete with the book.
Hmm.
So I don't know. It always bothered me. And I don't know if it's a thing about my father and me, but I, of all the things in my closet, I kept this unfinished book.
And are you now scouring eBay so that you can finish the book?
Wow. Look at you setting me up.
So, are you really?
So I
are
go really? On the eBay.
Okay. This was not planned. This was not planned. No way.
So I'm flipping through the book because I found it like while looking for that score, but I kept it out and I was flipping through it and I was getting some feels, right?
Yeah.
So I'm flipping through the book and I'm like, oh, look at, I'm just missing one there in the California A's or whoever it was, right? Not California A's. It would be the Oakland A's at the time. Isn't it, weren't the California A's for a while?
I don't think so, but I could be
California
wrong.
Angels?
That's the Angels are now they're the, I think they're the Anaheim Angels. Aren't
okay.
They?
Anyway,
I don't know. I don't keep track.
I'm flipping through.
It sounds reasonable.
All of our sports fans who also listen to our show, all three of them are saying,
they're yelling. They're like taking out their limited edition baseball bats and like beating the shit out of their.
So I'm flipping through and I was like, oh, look at, I'm missing one there. And so I opened up eBay and I typed in 1982 top sticker book, Johnny Bench or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And it pops up, Jeffrey.
One, a completed sticker book or just the
no,
stickers?
No, just that one sticker.
Just that one. Oh, no way.
With the back.
$472. No.
$1.97.
What? Buy now. Did you buy now?
Well,
please tell me.
I have
now.
More than that missing. So I go to the next page where I find things missing and I type it in $2.26.
No.
Go
way.
To the next thing. $6. Go to the next thing. I could complete the book for maybe $50, including shipping.
And?
Well, okay. So this is, I'm putting a pin in that for a second to ask you what your opinion is. Now, I've asked this of some of my friends a week ago. I am in a position in my life with my mental state and the way that I see the world, where I'm trying to figure out if I need to, I don't know, feel the way I felt as a kid in order to get past a couple things.
Wow. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if ordering these stickers off of eBay and sitting down at a table and opening the book, pulling the backs off those stickers, sticking them, closing the book as complete will do something, will be worth $50 and my time. Even as
I don't know that it will.
Even as a symbolic
man,
thing.
What a, yeah, I would spend the $50 to find out. I mean, look, you're talking to someone who was just not long ago talking to his wife about spending $300 for a Space 1999 Eagle model.
Right.
Because I had one as a kid and it was my favorite spaceship. Actually it was my favorite until I got the Millennium Falcon, but all that aside,
I think you should definitely get the,
I think there's value in going through these things, even if all they do is connect you back to those feelings and give you a little comfort in the present. You're tapping into that sort of past joy to fill the gap in the present. And I think there's value there.
Or is it even joy?
It might not be.
I'm not making that assumption necessarily. I don't know what I'm going to feel.
Yeah.
It could be cathartic. It could be negative. It could be positive. It might be nothing, right?
It could be Alec Baldwin buying, you know, spending $7,500 on the Apollo module and realizing that it wasn't what he thought it was going to be on 30 Rock.
I didn't see that episode, but I can understand exactly what he's saying. Now, one of my friends said, even you thinking about doing it has done the thing that it's going to do, so doing it is actually not worth it.
I don't know that I buy that. I really don't. I think there is value in the doing. And for me, there is the thinking. In fact, the thinking about the thing is where I would get spun up and stuck. I think in the doing of the thing is where I could let it go for better or for worse. You know, like you just said, I don't know if I'll feel joy. I don't know what I'll feel. It would be worth the 50 for me to find out what I felt.
Right.
Whether it was nothing or whether it was something.
The at least the mystery will be dispelled.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I mean, so like all of these things, going and trying to learn these tunes from 20 years ago or 30 years ago, or this book of baseball things. I remember, so when I was a kid, I don't know if I've talked about this before. When I was a kid, I had braces and I didn't wear my retainers.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of my teeth went wonky.
Yeah.
And it drove me crazy. And it was the kind of thing where I was kind of pissed at myself for not wearing my retainers. You know, like you went through all that, your parents spent all that money and like for nothing, basically, you know.
Did you feel guilt on not living up to their sort of bargain that they made, or was it a personal thing? Like, look at what I've done to myself. How did you reconcile that?
I think what I've done to myself,
mm-hmm.
like it just didn't make any sense. You know, I was just like, wait, why did I go through all that? And dentists had said to me, you know, oh, we could bond this one up and it wouldn't be as noticeable, like sort of cosmetic changes to fix things.
Yeah.
And I ended up, I think I maybe have talked about this, I ended up doing Invisalign a couple of years ago.
Right.
And for, you know, a year and a half or 2 years or whatever it is. And I still every single night put in my Invisalign things to keep my teeth straight because I went through all this stuff. But I feel better having actually fixed it the right way. This seems like a very your dad kind of thing. Am I wrong?
Not really. I mean, it's... whether or not it was the right way, whether or not it was John's way.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah,
and it's something that I unfortunately have learned very well.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, for me, it's. I think there's a sense of, you know, there's a right way to do this and the wrong way to do this. Yes, you could just use some super glue and fix it, or you could do it the right way and get your screw gun out and pre-drill the holes and whatever.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
like there's the right way to do it. And I feel like to some extent, it's like with a lot of this stuff, I know it's stupid. I know these things are in my past. I know there are unfinished photo projects that I let go. Mm-hmm. Right. And you mm-hmm. said something to me mm-hmm. the other day, you said, you know, maybe letting it go was the end of it. You know, like that
at the time and maybe, you know, what. Maybe at that time, letting it go was the right thing, but that doesn't, I don't think that precludes what you're going through in terms of or not precludes, maybe it's the wrong word, negates you finding value in picking it up again. Just because it was right then doesn't necessarily mean that it's right now.
Right. But it could also be that you're second guessing something that you knew when you were in front of it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, oh, I should have broken up with that girl. Well, you decided to break up with that girl at that time. So there must have been a reason why you did it.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah. It can fall into that realm of circular logic, though, where you're talking yourself into or out of XYZ.
You? And not me?
Right.
You must be talking about somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I was just telling Adrian this morning that I want to make a shirt that just says overthink, over engineer.
Yeah.
And that's all it says.
I have, you know, my bio on my website. I think it says, you know, take portrait, obsess, repeat.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, that is 100% accurate.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, Have there been things in the, since I've known you that you work things that you were working on, things you did that you didn't finish that you still think about?
Yes. Yeah.
Are there? Are,
yeah. There are. Yeah. And there are things that I value differently. You know, we were talking about, you know, sort of past work history. And for a long time, I think that if you asked me, Adrian and I were talking about this, if you asked me what my best job was, I would have said, you know, being an art director at Universal Studios. It paid me the most money I've ever made. It was the most visibility that I've ever experienced on work that I mean, millions of eyeballs a day looking at the things that I did.
Sure.
However, and this is kind of, other than a very few projects, I can't tell you what I did there.
Sure.
I don't remember much of anything beyond a few key projects.
So
however,
was it, wait,
however,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Was it the work or was it the audience that you're remembering?
I think it was the perceived status and reach.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough.
Because if you look at something like, I remember every prop that I built out of college at Texas Shakespeare. I remember everything I built at Alabama. I remember New York. I remember the special effects house that I worked at. I remember all of these things that were, I remember more fondly all of these things that were collaborative, that were more directly a group of people working toward a common endpoint.
Sure.
I find more meaning in that. And I think that's one of the reasons I'm going back to, you know, 3D and some of this, sort of trying to rehone some of those skills that I had when I was still a theater major, whether that's, you know, building something other than paintings in the studio or sewing or, you know, I was gifted a 3D printer recently. So I'm, you know, even more so interested in getting back into 3D to see what I can do with this thing. Not that I want to create a 3D printed product line, but just to explore it, to explore that side of art and engineering, of form and function, of, you know, all of those kinds of things that I, in many ways, allowed myself to minimize in the pursuit of reach and because reach was importance, right? Reach was validation. You know,
some people could argue that it still is
it more so than ever.
Yeah.
However, I have instead chosen to pursue resonance, not reach.
Sure.
And I think you and I are similar in that, there comes a point, or there came a point for me, I won't speak for anybody else. There came a point for me where chasing sort of velocity and chasing scale and chasing reach, which, spoiler, you can't control. Mm. You don't have any control over that. That realization that I'm leaving meaning and resonance and maybe self-awareness on the table in favor of chasing these other things that I can't control anyway, but then beating the snot out of myself when inevitably I didn't meet some imaginary sort of escape velocity.
Yeah. Right. And is it because you didn't give enough time, or that you shouldn't have had that goal in the first place?
Wait, say that again, please.
That you didn't give, like, if you abandon something because you don't reach escape velocity.
Yeah.
Is it because you didn't give it enough time, or that was the wrong goal to be reaching for in the first place?
I think probably the latter, you know, but I was taught to just, you know, that effort. Effort is, you know, that's the thing. Like I did it with the book, with Photography by the Letter.
Sure.
You know, version one didn't sell that well.
Right.
So, well, I know what I'll do. I'll make it bigger. I'll make it better. I'll put more into it. Did that make a difference? No.
Right.
I just spent all kinds of time. It was the wrong thing. Not the wrong thing, because I learned an extraordinary amount of stuff.
Yeah, but regardless, you did it and it's done and it exists in the world.
That's right. And that's the value. Not the fact that it did or didn't sell, which I don't have any control over. What I did have control over was how well it was researched, how well it was designed, how well it was written, yeah, how well it looked, you know?
Yep.
That's what I had control over. And time and time again, I've, and maybe this is true for you, I've let the external stuff get in my internal head and squeeze the life out of me.
Yes.
Or squeeze the interest out of me, or squeeze the curiosity out of me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's so easy to feel daunted. I saw a little video online the other day where some speaking, it was like a word, you know, like one of those people who discusses like the etymology and the history of
stuff.
Yeah,
right? Sure.
And he was saying that there is a influencer's voice online, like the way they talk is a specific way.
Oh, it's annoying. There's a cadence to it.
Yeah. And it's because the world has sort of evolved to where that is the most, they found that this is the most engaging thing. So they all lean into that. That Mr. Beast didn't talk the way Mr. Beast talks now. When he started, he slowly got to there because that was sort of like the iterate. And he ended up at this place that is the most effective, right?
That's what people respond most to. Okay.
And I think that, you know, people like you and I, for better or for worse, I mean, one could argue that in some sort of evolutionary battle, survival of the fittest capitalist thing, you should basically do what the market wants. And if the market wants a bigger version of the book, make the bigger version of the book or whatever, right? Like that.
And that's the belief system that you get stuck in.
But yeah, man, because I don't know. Because maybe it's that the first person who really connected with people online spoke a certain way and everyone just started speaking the way they were speaking. It's like that Zay Frank video, you know.
Right.
I'm here because I'm wearing red swim trunks. And so everyone wears red swim trunks and they don't catch the wave. And it's like it has nothing to do with your trunk color.
Right.
And as you get older and you do things and they work, or you do things and they don't work, and you realize that, like, hey, we're all going to die someday. And 100 years from now, there's going to be a whole other group of people and no one's going to remember any of us. It's like, what are we obsessing about?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, I'm writing something right now around a lot of this. And that thing around reach and that's a big part of it, right? And the social media stuff, it's easy to see because these platforms are built to reward reach and reward velocity, and you know, algorithms are rewarding frequency and the markets are rewarding their own sort of momentum. And one of the things that I said in the piece is when something is amplified, it quietly reshapes what we believe counts.
Yes.
And in this sort of, I can't speak for any, you know, other industries, but in the creative industry, I think it's detrimental because we, and you and I have joked about this in the past, we're in a landscape where content can mean so many things.
Yes.
It can mean a really shitty TikTok video or a clip from a Scorsese movie. Yep. And that's, I can't reconcile that. I can't put all of that in one bucket.
And that attention can be bought.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's not a fair fight.
No. No. And I get it from a position of privilege to even talk about it and realize it and go, well, I don't have to do this and this. I understand that, but I am where I am with it. And I'm finally at a point where I realize, you know, we've sort of seen behind the curtain, right?
Sure.
And we've seen that it's kind of, we're being force fed something that maybe doesn't sustain all of us. Right. Just because it's food doesn't mean it's nutritious.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm trying to figure out what that nutrition has to be for me to feel, I don't know, satiated, I guess. I don't know.
Where do you think you got the definition of satiated? Is that an innate thing or is that a learned?
Oh, I think it was learned. You know, I think it was drilled into me. Money, benefits, sure. Security.
Sure. Do parents do that just because they're scared that their kids are going to be in pain and be sad? And you know what I mean?
I think so. I mean, look,
it's not a fear, right? To some extent.
I think it is. I think my parents both wanted the best for me. I can't speak for everybody else, but I think that my parents both wanted the best for me. They had very different ways of seeing what that meant and expressing that to me.
Sure.
And I think that's part of what has been hard to reconcile is there were two so dramatically different, like polar opposite views of the world and views of what it means to be happy and successful and what success looks like and what happiness looks like and how you achieve those things.
Like,
and
you grew up in the Fablemans.
Yeah, right.
Steven?
Yeah. So it became hard to really know what I wanted and sure. Who I wanted to be and who I wanted to be around and what I wanted to explore, because there were these two competing sort of voices. And for a long time, and you know this to be true because we've talked about it for 700,000 hours, it was easier to blame my dad for it.
Sure.
But there was also a set of expectations levied by my mom.
Sure.
There were also, you know, you can do anything. You're good at everything you do. Like, all of that sort of building up because she wanted to instill confidence. But what happened was, and this was, goes back to my conversation with my friend Michael. He said, your ego used to enter the room before your talent.
Yeah.
And he said, if you just would have flipped that and let your talent speak before you did, you would have ended up in a very different place, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that you know, you have one person telling you you can do anything and you have the other person telling you,
you won't amount to anything.
Yeah. Or you won't amount to anything if you go down that road.
Yeah. And so because these are both people of trust, these are your caregivers, right? These are your caregivers. These are people looking out for you. You're like, well, who do I believe?
Yeah.
Which path do I choose? What, I don't know.
Yep.
And I became this sort of this contradiction. Sometimes I feel this way. Sometimes I feel that way because I'm responding and reacting to whatever voice happens to pop up in my head, whatever old tape happens to pop up in my head at the time. And I'm ignoring or not taking that moment of stillness to listen to my voice.
Sure.
And I think you've had similar things in your life.
Would you have been able to find the answers, though, had you not had the outside stuff? I mean, you know, could you have found it on your own?
I don't.
Or would you have felt like you were just in a void with no guideposts?
I don't think I could have, or I don't think I would have. You know, one of the things I've been working on kind of quietly in the background is this piece around the teachers that really shaped me. Teachers both in school and out of school. And the influences that I allowed in and the ones that I sort of backed away from because they didn't fit in line maybe with what my dad said or my mom said or society said or it's just interesting as I've been kind of going back, and maybe it's part of maybe it's a memoir or something, I don't know, but it's going back and looking at what shaped me. And I think for a long time I tried to blame my dad for it. And look, to be fair, like he did some damage, but he wasn't the only one who influenced or affected me. Sure. And I think it became easy to cast him as the villain.
Sure.
It became very easy for me to wear the white hat and him to wear the black hat, and he's to blame for all of it.
Right.
But that's not true. That's not true, because there's a whole world of gray. There's a whole world of gray on between those who try to pull you down and those who try to lift you up.
And even the people who are pulling you down, they may think they're doing it for the right reasons.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. There's, you know, that Scott Galloway guy online?
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, online. Yeah, yeah.
Like sometimes, I think it was him. He's like one of those guys who will say, you know, if you're in your 20s, you should never be at home. You should be out connecting with people, you know, whatever. You know, like he has like good. Yeah.
Who are you supposed to be connecting
with? You should be out in the world, like bumping into people, because like that's how your life is made. I don't disagree with. But then he'll also be just like, the worst thing that anybody could possibly say is to follow your dreams, you know, like those kinds of things, you know.
Yeah.
And it may be true that on average, it's insane to think that you can go your own way and have a life that is not tragic or frustrating, or maybe it is. And maybe the tragic frustrating is better than bored and unresolved. You know what I mean? Like, you know, there's no life that is easy. Even the easy lives you have, you know, I could have married a millionaire, right? You know, or, you know, a super rich person, or somebody came from a rich family and never had, you know, sure. But like, there's costs that come with that too. You know, there's the cost of the unknown, what could have been, whether you're truly in love, blah, 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 right? You know, the jobs that you choose to do, the people you choose to follow, the places you choose to live. I could have, maybe there's some version of Bill who lives in, you know, Iowa, who's happy living on a farm, you know, dealing with cows and fields all day long. Maybe I chose this one, right? And you can't undo it. You can't do it all over again. You only have one life to lead. You only have one sheet of paper.
Yeah.
And it's,
but it's interesting that we're going back, both of us. And I imagine that this is true for some of the people listening, and we're trying to erase some of those things, or at least maybe strike through them and see what else is there.
Yeah. I mean,
and I don't know if that's just getting older. I don't know if it's, I mean, I know part of it for me is the more I can do to keep me from focusing on so much of the stuff that's going on that I don't understand or don't agree with or can't reconcile.
Yeah.
I'm in a better mental space, and you know, Adrian knows when I've looked at the news.
Sure.
She knows when I've allowed myself to go a little too deep. My mood changes, my demeanor changes. I'm snappy or I'm angry, I'm sad. Like all those range of emotions.
Sure.
But when I'm writing, when I'm painting, when I'm, you know, exploring something that I find, you know, interesting. I'm replacing the sink in our middle bathroom. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to do it very carefully so that I don't, I'm removing the tile around the sink, and then hopefully going to be able to lift the sink out and replace it with another sink from 1957 that we found online. But this process of very methodically removing grout, and, you know, you're treating these tiles like loose baby teeth. You know, you sure. You can hear them. You can hear when they're just ready to give way from the mortar and they pop up, and it's never going to lead to a job. It's never going to lead to a career, but I'm finding that process incredibly satisfying.
Sure. I get that.
And I think I'm at a point in my life where I'm leaning more into those things that I find satisfying and valuable and worthy, whether or not anyone in the rest of the world does.
Yeah.
Because that's what I can control those things to a degree.
And you can still do them.
And I can still do them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, would anybody hire me? And let me be clear. Nobody would hire me to do this kind of work, because it's taken me,
I was going to say,
forever.
They need a bathroom. Jeffrey.
Yeah, right. I know. Here's a bucket. I'm going to be here for a while, you know, like it, but it's so satisfying. And I think one of the things that, to go back to what you were saying about your baseball cards and even your piano, you don't know what's going to come out of it, but you also don't know what that bubble, what the other bubble that that bubble is going to bump into.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. You don't know that doing the work you're doing right now is not going to end up, you know, maybe it's not you becoming a tile worker,
right,
but maybe working with the tiles makes you go, yeah, I haven't played with mosaics before or whatever.
100%. Or, you know what? I did this. Okay. Maybe I can refinish the deck.
Yeah.
Maybe I can do this, this, and this. It's a confidence, and it's a satisfaction of a job well done. And it's all of these things that I think are important just because you get to do them, not because they have some sort of financial upside or I'm not posting about my sink journey. I'm not, I'm not doing a tile a day, you know, that stuff has no interest for me anymore, but it did have an interest for me. And it wasn't the interest in the thing. It was the promise, the implied promise of, if you do this and do this and do this, you're going to get rewarded with this.
Right. Which doesn't exist.
For me, it does not.
Yeah.
I mean, other people, it might, you know, but
correlation does not mean causation, right?
No. I mean, you can't just go, I'm going to go write a bestseller, or sure, I'm going to go, you know, make an Oscar winning film. I mean, sure, you can try that. You know,
fool.
But yeah, I mean, did Ryan Coogler really anticipate that, you know, Michael B. Jordan would win Best Actor and that Sinners would win Best Ensemble?
Sure.
I think he wanted that, but you can't build for it.
No.
You can't design for it.
No, you can't. Yeah, you can't. I mean, I'm sure there are people who do plan for that, but I think they usually fall on their butts.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that it's that one-to-one. You know?
Yeah.
It's not that obvious. It's weird. It's weird when you come to realize that the cause and effect that you think exists and that they teach you when you were younger really isn't true.
Yeah. Work hard, do well. That's not true.
Yeah.
I know lots of people who work hard that are struggling.
And vice versa.
And vice versa, yeah. See, students, you know, are doing, you know, they're billionaires that are running the world, you know.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
The you're exactly right. I think that you know that promise of, you know, of a meritocracy doesn't exist.
Yeah, and that just but the problem is that it's your average person who's not some rich kid is not going to be a success unless they work hard. You know what I'm saying? Like, for some people it does require hard work, for some people it doesn't. And then hard work doesn't guarantee anything. It's like everything's graded on a curve. Everybody's got, what's the thing in golf?
A handicap. Look at that. Me with the sports reference.
There you go. I mean, this is teamwork right here. I've got, you know, your theater thing.
Yeah.
I've got a little story for you.
Hit me. I love theater stories. I've been binge watching Bridgerton. So, you know, hit me.
So, there was this show, Operation Mincemeat, here in New York. It was
a play, Operation Mincemeat.
Musical.
Okay.
A farcical musical about the World War II thing where they dropped a dead body off the coast of Spain with fake plans attached to its wrist. And then the Germans found it.
Wait.
Did you know about this?
Okay, no.
Oh, this is a true story. There's a Netflix movie with Colin Firth from a few years ago that you can watch.
Oh, really?
Like a serious movie. So they wanted to show that we weren't attacking. We were going to attack Sicily, but the Germans had a lot of reinforcements there. We wanted to make them think we were going to go in through Sardinia. So we put fake plans that said we were going in through Sardinia on a dead body, dropped it off the coast of Spain. It was picked up by German spies. They thought the plans were real and they moved their people to Sardinia and we went into Sicily. This is a true story.
They didn't see that as kind of a...
Well, there was this stuff going on all over the place, right? It's like, what do you believe? Okay. What don't you believe? That's all part of the story. But this British, actually, they might have been Scottish, British, but I think they were in Scotland at the time. Anyway, these three people and a musician ended up writing a musical about this whole thing before the other movie came out. This is like when it was on a, actually, they learned it from a Stuff You Should Know episode.
That's funny.
Is where they found it. Anyway, so these three people made this musical and it, they did it little tiny thing, you know, in the middle of nowhere in some little theater. And it was enough that it got to a bigger theater and a bigger theater and then the West End and then Broadway.
Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So my wife buys tickets to Broadway stuff all the time just because she's like, oh, we're in New York. Let's go see stuff. So she'll buy tickets for stuff. So last year, she bought tickets for this Operation Mincemeat. And I was like, I don't know. Is this going to be good? You know what I mean? Like, because like some stuff we see wasn't good. And it was funny because
then they dropped the body and it had the plans.
Well, kind of. Yeah. But it's, yeah. So we went to see that and we were going to go see Glengarry Glen Ross with a bunch of famous people, Odenkirk and Mike McKean and all these different people.
Really? I really want to see Dog Day Afternoon with John Barenthal.
So I wanted to see that one, right? I wanted to see both, but like I was excited about The Mammoth.
Yeah.
And The Mammoth, I didn't really like. Operation Mincemeat was great. So we said...
But you know the material for Mammoth. Was it the performance? Was it the casting?
Yeah, what? I didn't... Really? Culkin, Kieran Culkin was in it.
Kieran Culkin?
Didn't like him.
He does one thing.
Yep.
He's
and
just
that's exactly what he did on stage. And it was fine. It was good, but it wasn't worth, you know, hundreds of dollars that it cost for the ticket. Right.
Yeah.
So we went and saw this Mincemeat thing. It was great. And then we saw, oh, my mom would get a kick out of this because she likes sort of old school sort of musical kind of things. And that's what this was.
Like Pajama Game or something.
So we went and saw this with my mom. And it's five people on stage playing all of the roles. So they'll go off stage, they'll come back on like with like a mustache on and a hat and they'll do the part. And then they'll like go behind someone else and take the mustache and the hat off and become themselves again on the other side of the person. You know,
that's funny.
It's really well done, like extremely well done. And these people have been doing it for like 5 years. And it was the original cast from London that was on stage, including three of the people who wrote the show.
Wow.
So next, the summertime comes. And the company that Heather works for got tickets to go with a group of people and they had an extra ticket. So I went. And in the meantime, I had been DMing with a couple of the people in the cast. And one of them, she and I became friends. And so I took pictures of her and Claire and Heather and I and Claire's husband when he was in town. We went to see some jazz. It was fun. We'd like, you know.
Yeah.
And so last week was the last shows before they ended their run. The original cast ended their run forever. Like this.
Wait,
is the
so
last
has it been
time.
On Broadway for
it's
5 years?
No, it's been going for 5 years. They started like in 2019. They got to the West End in like 2022 or 23. And then last year they came to Broadway. But they've been working on this stupid thing for 7 years. You know what I mean? Like it's just 8 years. And I think they were all just sort of burnt out because it's exhausting, as you know, doing these shows all the time. So anyway, it was their last shows last weekend, not this 2 days ago, but a week ago. So we got tickets to go on Friday night. And I said to, we pinged Claire and we just said, hey, listen, we'll be there on Saturday night. Just so like, you know, break a leg, whatever.
Right.
And so we go to the show with cousins of Heather's and a couple of friends of ours. And we see the show. Show was great. Kind of sad because it's the second to the last show they're doing, you know? So there's like people are losing their minds in the audience because there's people who are huge super fans of this. There was a big article in the New York Times of some woman who writes for the theater in New York Times who saw it like 14 times in the last year because she became obsessed with this show. It's got like people dress up as the characters and go to the show. It's like a whole Rocky Horror. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So we go to the show. We leave the show. It's like, hey, that was really great. Whatever it is. And I turn off airplane mode on my phone and a message pops up from Claire. She says, hey, I put you guys, I don't know, this is during intermission. I missed it. I put you guys on the list to come backstage if you want to come backstage.
Wait, but you were already gone at this point?
We were already outside the theater.
Gotcha.
And I was like, crap, were we supposed to be in the theater to get, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know how this works.
How do we do this?
Yeah. So I'm like,
is there a secret knock on the stage door?
Now, the thing is that, as I said, super fans and whatever it is, there's 200 people at the stage door. Wow. Waiting for them to come out, you know?
Yeah.
And so I'm just like, I don't know what to do, whatever. So I wrote her. I was like, hey, listen, we already went outside. I'm sorry. I screwed up. I just saw this message. Like, it's fine if it's all right. I don't know what to do, whatever. And she writes back. She goes, no, just go find the security people at the stage door. So I go to the stage door and there's this guy there who was the guy who was organizing people to go to the bathroom during intermission. You know, like, all right, stand against the wall, men against the wall, women over there. You know, that whole thing. And he was really efficient. And I made a comment to him while we were in line for the bathroom. I was like, you do a really good job keeping this flowing. But
yeah. No. Wow. There it is.
And he was like, oh, thanks. You know, whatever, we try. And so this guy's there. And I said, listen, I'm not trying to be like one of those people, but like, Claire told me to talk to somebody. And apparently we're on some list. He goes, yeah, I've been waiting for you. Where have you been?
I've got urinals to marshal. What are you doing?
And he's just like, you have three people with you? I was like, yeah. Three. And we go past the 200 people into the stage door.
Nice.
And we're on the stage. Just us.
Oh.
Waiting on the stage for her to come down and say hi to us.
You started singing, didn't you?
Well, I'll tell you, the stage was much smaller than it looks from the audience.
Hmm.
Like way smaller. Like I can't.
Well, they say that, you know, theater makes the stage look 10 feet larger.
No, I swear, if the stage was 20 feet across, I'd be surprised. Like it was like it felt, it probably was, but it just felt small, you know. And then we're on stage, like, and there's like there's prop telephones on the wall on stage, you know, as part of the show and whatever it is. I'm like, look at this, this is the phone that we've been watching for the last year.
Hello, engine room.
Yeah. So, we end up, so Claire comes out and like, is like saying hi to, you know, and she knows my wife and I, and like, we had a couple friends with us and she says hi to them and we take a picture, whatever it is. We're talking about our next moves, whatever. And then like, she showed us all backstage, all the props and like where they're organized. Cause I mean, it's like, cause there's no one even has time to drink water in this show. Cause it's, you know, 2.5 hours of like straight, whatever it is. And just like looking at everything. And it's just so amazing. Backstage stuff at a theater. The fact that they do these things as well as they do.
Yeah.
Is just mind blowing. You know, it's like just professionals on like a 27th level.
Yeah.
And just seeing it all, having seen the show before, and then like, oh, look, there's that prop that's on stage for 25 seconds in that little cubby right there, labeled, you know, thing that's on stage for 24 seconds. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was just amazing. And my friend Chris is like was a theater guy in college and afterwards and stuff. And he was like, this is so cool. You know, like just looking around at all this stuff. Anyway, it was just like one of those like moments of even the, you know, and I think Chris made a point. He's just like, you know, it's funny how everything they're doing here is exactly what you do in college or on a small off-Broadway. Like they're not doing anything special. They're just doing it really well at a crazy good level.
Yep.
You know?
Sometimes you do want to see how the sausage is made.
Yes.
And it's not disappointing. You know, it's the meeting your heroes. It's all of that. It's, you know, I don't think that many people, I mean, hardcore theater fans do, but I don't think the general public realizes what goes into a production, even a small production.
Yeah. Even one like this. I mean, it's on Broadway, but it's a 700 person theater. You know what I mean? It's not Wicked.
And when you get somebody like your friend Claire to kind of walk you through it show you that it's similar to my friend Michelle, you know, walking through shows at the National Gallery and getting, well, here's what we had to do to this, to treat this piece. Yep. And oh, this artist is beget this artist. And here's why you need to know this. That little bit of extra context can make for people who are wired to appreciate it can make absolutely all the difference.
Absolutely. And the thing is that, you know, most of these people, I mean, most of these people, all of these people, they're just people, right? I mean, they're just somebody doing their job.
Yeah.
You know, Claire was doing 9 shows that week because she had 9 shows to do. Like, it's like, yep. Just like the guy who picks up his jackhammer out on the street, she's picking up her, you know, her pants and putting them on to get on stage to do the thing for the people. I know.
It's just, well, I think it's amazing. We were talking about, it's such a funny industry, you know, because we're in awards season, you know, the actor awards and the Golden Globes, and everybody's got an award show. And I wonder about the validity of this stuff, of course, but I don't know where I'm going with this. I'll put a pin in this for now.
All right.
I think that there is value in seeing people doing, and not to say that actors don't do it for the love of it, but I think there's a difference, and maybe you would agree, there's a difference between an actor and a movie star.
Yes, very much so.
And by and large, the theater community, because you're not being paid tens of millions of dollars, I think there can be a different motivation. You know, some people it is the material and it's being an actor and it's the community and all that. I understand that. But there are also those who are really in it for the money and the fame. Sure. and the notoriety, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Yep.
But if I were an actor, I would probably want to be a theater actor.
Yeah, you mean the hardest actor to be?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're earning that $400 a week or whatever it is you get as an equity player. But there was something, you know, there was something about it. Whether or not I ever go back, whether or not I ever do anything, I think I'm learning an appreciation for how sort of incredible it was and how moving it was to have been afforded the opportunity to go through it at all.
Yes. Yeah.
And maybe that's something that you're feeling with music. Maybe you're not going to play Madison Square Garden, but the fact that you have had this set of experiences and have had the education that you have and have met the people on the back of it, and that you understand and appreciate all the sort of nuance and levels of craft and care that go into making music or being a musician or whatever it is, there is something grounding about making those realizations that maybe we needed time away. Maybe we needed years away. Maybe we needed to be in our 40s and 50s to really be able to appreciate it in a way that for like people like your friend Claire, that appreciation is just innate for her because she's doing it every day. She's living her best life.
Sure.
And I'm making an assumption here. Yeah. I don't know her, but you know,
but then again, she may have a different perspective on it 10 years from now. I mean, she was in Les Mis in London when she was a kid.
Wow.
She was in High School Musical when she was younger, like on stage in London, you know.
Wow.
And then she came back to it. But, you know, but I'm sure her vision of being in Les Mis back then now is different than it was back then. You know what I mean? Like our perspective of the things we've achieved in our lives change with the way we change. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
Like, so not only we collect experiences, but we also collect perspectives.
I think that's true. I think that's true.
It's just kind of neat. And
sometimes we hold on to them longer than they are useful, speaking for myself, but,
sure. Yeah. But I mean, I think that sometimes the facts don't change, but the way we see the facts changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that is maybe what we're trying to do a lot of the time, right? Is like just to change our perspective on the facts.
Yeah, man. I think on the back of a year and a half of therapy now, I think perspective and expectation are the two things that have been the most challenging and the things that have been the most rewarding to keep working through.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you to Claire for hooking us up to go backstage because it was pretty neat.
What a terrific experience.
And then when we were leaving, you know, there's like all the people, because most of the rest of the cast was already out there signing autographs, and we're like just walking past them, like behind them.
Nice.
And people are like, who are those people?
Yeah. Yeah. Why?
It's like, yeah.
Over here.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I would like to, you know, it's such a schlep for us to go up to like New York and yeah. and then see a show. But I really would like to see Dog Day Afternoon with Eben Moss and John Barenthal.
Is that running right now?
I don't know if the, I don't know if they're in previews or if it started. I think it may have started.
Limited 16 weeks as of March 10th. Previews start yeah. March 10th. Opening night okay. is March 30th.
And they're not that expensive. Tickets are not that expensive. I think they're you can get them for less than 100 a piece, which, I mean, yes, that's expensive for an evening out, but it's...
for Broadway, it's cheap.
It's yeah, for Broadway, it's not that expensive.
Oh, the August Wilson Theater. I know where that is. Okay.
Is that a good place?
It's yeah, small place. It's yeah. What do we see at the August? Oh no, it's not small. What did I see there? It's a big place actually. What did we see at August Wilson? Let's look at the Wikipedia entry and see notable productions because it'll tell me exactly what was playing there recently. Oh, it was the Cabaret at the Kit Kat Club. It was Cabaret was
Ooh,
playing there.
See, I wanted to see that. I love
I saw
that
it. It was okay.
Really?
Yeah. It was. Mm. Okay. So you didn't miss anything.
All right.
In my opinion. Hey, I have can I throw out a photographer of the week?
Of course.
Alice Seeley Harris. This is a tough one.
Three names. Wow. All right.
Alice Seeley Harris.
Seeley Harris.
She was an English missionary, early documentary photographer, went to the Congo Free State, King Leopold, like stuff where they were cutting people's hands off and stuff like
oh,
that.
Oh, Jesus.
In Yeah, exactly. In wow. 1897, after 7 years of trying, she was accepted to go to the Congo Free State and went there and like took pictures of the atrocities wow. and all the rest of it. And she lived until 1970. So she was alive when you were alive.
Hard stuff to look at.
Oh, yes. I will put a, what was that? Yeah, what is that? A
not
warning?
Safe,
a,
not safe for work kind
no.
of thing or
yeah. super, super rough. Like this is, you know, actual real atrocity, rough stuff. But this woman in 1897 was there
was
as a missionary
photographing
and saw wow. what was going on and took pictures. And the pictures that she and others took are the reason why we even knew any of this stuff was going on.
Really? Did her photographs affect any sort of change on what was taking place, or was she simply there to document?
I think she was there just as a missionary and had a camera.
Ah, okay, okay.
And so she, in some ways, she you know got a, you know she was allowed, and her pictures got out, and they began her husband started working for the Congo Reform Association in early 1906. They toured the United States. And John wrote that they presented their images at 200 meetings in 49 cities via magic lantern screenings. You know, these magic lanterns?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like a wow. big projector, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so they were showing these things to show, like, the atrocities that were going on, the severed hands and feet and all the rest of it, the whipping, the hostage taking, rape, murder, burning of villages. Like, it's because of her that we know that a lot of this stuff went on. So... I'm trying to pull out.
Apparently there's a book of hers called The Camera and the Congo Crime.
Oh God, not a book I need to own.
No, 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 no.
But wow. I'm trying
and
to
what
highlight.
What were they cutting off hands for? Like for thieves?
It was punishment for not making enough rubber.
So we're going to take your ability to make rubber.
If you don't collect enough rubber, we're going to cut your hand off.
So then you can't make any more rubber.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's kind of silly. But they would also, I don't know if you see on their Wikipedia page, there's a picture of a father looking at his child's severed foot and hand.
I don't need to see that.
Yep. Because they threatened her because he wasn't doing a good enough job.
Oh, wow. Of his five-year-old daughter. Okay, that's bad.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
That's
yep,
bad.
Yep, yep.
Okay, well.
So, I mean, but I don't say this to be, you know, I'm not trying to be trite or anything like that. I'm trying to highlight photographers, especially female photographers, who you may not have heard of, who were doing the thing at a time when no one was doing it, let alone female photographers getting in there to be able to do it and be known, you know?
How was she kept safe documenting all of this? They couldn't have wanted this information to get out, did they? Or did they not care?
Well, I mean, I think in 1900, it's not like it was going up on Instagram, they were tracking her down.
Right.
You know?
But even, I mean, she's standing there with a camera. Yeah. Did they not know what the camera was?
I think a lot of times she was taking pictures of people who had these things happen to her, you know, so it was like after the bad guys left, as it were.
Wow. Wow, lived to 100.
100 years old, 1970. She saw the moon landing.
Wow.
I mean, wow. Sometimes I think about that kind of stuff, and I was like, this person was born in
moon landing, in quotes.
Yeah, uh-huh. You mean she saw the Kubrick faking of the moon landing?
Yeah, she saw the production of the moon landing. Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought that would be, it's a worthwhile sort of, it's a tough one, but I think it's, you know.
4 days later, as her honeymoon, Alice sailed with John on the SS Cameroon to the Congo Free State as missionaries with the Congo Balolo Mission. They arrived in the Congo 3 months later, August 4th, 1898, and then traveled to the mission station Ikao near Basankusu. She was appalled and saddened at what she witnessed there and began campaigning for human rights of the Congolese natives to be recognized.
Yep.
Wow. I mean, so at some point, next time, perhaps.
Okay.
Campaigning for human rights. It would be interesting to talk about photography as a source of social and political change, not just aesthetic enjoyment.
Sure. I mean, that's kind of what I was getting at here, but
that would be interesting to dive into. And maybe, you know, you look at certainly Don McCullen and Larry Burroughs and there are the poster kids for that. Right. But then there are probably countless others like this woman, Alice Seeley Harris, who you've never heard of.
Yep.
And I would imagine, especially as a woman with a camera, she may have found herself in precarious situations. I can't imagine that. I really can't.
Yeah, there you go.
All right.
Live up-to-the-minute updates, really turning 180 degrees right now. Apple just released a new studio display.
I saw that. And they've also released
a
new
display XDR. So it's just HDR version.
Is it 32 inch?
No, it's 27.
It's 27 for what, $3,500 or something? I thought they were going to release a 32 inch.
I'm not interested in a better 27 inch. I want the big one. Maybe we get to be able to, or the big ones will be even more expensive now that you can't really get them.
Well, they also did an M5 Air and they doubled the base storage for the same price.
$100 more than the previous thing, but you get 512.
Oh, that's right. It is. It's $1099.
But you get 512 gigs, which is fine.
What was that? $400 as an upgrade?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a couple hundred bucks, I think. So in the end, it actually is not bad. It's crazy that they've decided to up the base storage on these things just when the base storage has gotten really, really expensive.
Yeah. I mean, there's all this RAM storage. If you haven't been following
RAMs, you know, and RAMs SSDs being, tripled in price.
Yeah. They're being gobbled up by data centers before AI implodes, and then you'll be able to buy them on the cheap.
And the new MacBook Pro came out too with the new chips, which I'm going to wait till the next one comes out. I'm still rocking an M1 Max, MacBook 14 inch, but I think, and I'm going to wait until I think the new ones are supposed to be smaller, like not this one that just came out, but by the end of the year, they're talking the M6 is supposed to be a redesigned case with a.
But think about this in 5 years. Right. The you can get a chip now. The M5 Air, they say, is 6.5 times, not percent, 6.5 times faster than the M1. I mean, that's a remarkable achievement.
Is it really six times faster?
That's what they're saying. Than M1, not M1 Max, just the standard M1.
Sure.
For $1,000. And you know,
I mean, the computers are really, I mean, that for $1,000, that M whatever Air, the M4, M now M5 Air.
M5 Air.
Unbelievable amount of power for the amount of money.
Yes.
It's just, especially considering what that would have been a $500 computer 20 years ago.
Yeah.
Or 10 years ago or whatever, you know, whatever the, you know, in 2010, that would be $500. And now it's $1,000 because of inflation. It's like, well, man, that's a really good deal.
Yeah. But
now they're coming out with a cheaper one.
In the 80s, it would have been $5,000.
Yeah, which is the equivalent of like a car. And people still bought these things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. I have to go to a fancy dinner. Lunch. I got to go put a suit on.
A suit?
Yeah. Of armor. So we'll get this up later. But thank you, Jeffrey. That was fun.
Yeah. All right, my friend. Pleasure as always. Thank you.
We'll talk to you later. I can finally eat my English muffin.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to go make some breakfast. Going on and on the way we are for so long. To any fool, it's plain to see something's wrong. This way, say what you want to say, though I know your words will lay me out, so I can hear you think out loud. Going through your thoughts the way I have for too long. It's clear to me the this way, say what you wanna say, I know what you will say.